down the side of the mass and suddenly came to an opening. Light flashes or shining white objects were being swept into the opening by turbulence. They may have been gas or some sort of energy crystals. Further down, the same thing happened in reverse. Light flashes or shining white objects were coming out again at a lower level. It was surprising that the water in this deep area was green instead of black near the pyramid, even at night. Now, that was Harry Marshall's report of his underwater exploration. Now, here's Ed Wilson's report of his overwater. I circled around it for about a minute and a half. I could even see barnacles on it and water running past the top of it. At my point of angle and from my position, I could clearly see it was a monstrous building. The sun was radiating in such a way that in its rays I could see. Now, let me show you something. This area is strange. In 1950, back to this story. We'll get back to that. In 1950, I was news editor. Got to put all these things. This is very interesting. In 1950, I was news. You know, when I say am I boring you, I check up on whether or not you got an interest category or an interest capacity. It interests me. It interests anybody. It's smart. 1950, I was news editor of an Indiana radio station. On September 16th of that year, the Associated Press released in Miami, Florida, a short feature story by E.V.W. Jones, perhaps the first newsman. Oh, this is The Devil's Triangle 2 by Richard Weiner. I don't know where to get one of these. If I could, I'd tell you. If we can find them, we'll get them. By E.V.W. Jones, perhaps the first newsman to take notice of the series of total vanishments in the area. It covered the Flight 19 disappearance, the five torpedo planes and the mariner that went to search for them, and 27 men vanished without a trace. His story also covered the total disappearance of three airline planes and two ships. Total disappearance. No oil slick. No debris. Nothing. Intrigued by the account, I placed the story in my personal file of the bizarre and bewildering. Perhaps the first national magazine article to deal with these events as a series was by George X. Sand, appearing in the October 1952 issue of Fate. It covered the same disappearance as the AP story, but in far greater depth, and added the case of internationally famous horse racing jockey Al Snyder. The jockey vanished with two friends while on a fishing trip. Not a trace. That, too, went into my file. As time allowed, I launched a research campaign. This is a guy writing the editorial to this Devil's Triangle 2, Vincent H. Gaddis. I launched a research campaign including instances of seaworthy vessels found strangely abandoned, as well as electromagnetic and meteorological erratics. Having turned to freelance writing, My article on the Devil's Triangle appeared in Argosy magazine in February 1964. It captured the interest of many readers and was reprinted in the Netherlands, Great Britain, Australia, and elsewhere, and was widely quoted. This data was rewritten and expanded in my book, Invisible Horizons, by Chilton, 1965, which is currently in its fifth printing. Today, the Devil's Triangle is a household term. Well, it needs to be resurrected. The people start asking some questions. There are many theories advocated to explain the Devil's Triangle mystery. Some are bizarre. Apollo astronauts and high-flying pilots have commented on the white water that appears in the region. It seems as if there is continual agitation stirring below the surface. Now, you know something. Those demons were assigned to the deep. Let me go on. It seems as if there is continual agitation stirring below the surface. Since Edgar Cayce, the famed psychic, placed Atlantis in this area, it has been suggested that the inhabitants of the lost continent left behind on the ocean floor a sophisticated power source that operates to create magnetic fields and stress on the surface and above. Whatever is the answer to the triangle mystery, magnetic and electrical forces seem to be a part of it. Radar images of objects in view appear and disappear from screens. Intense bluish glows can flood cockpits, and aircraft bodies can become luminous under conditions eliminating St. Elmo's fire. Electrical systems on some boats and planes have been completely burned out. In one instance, an airliner flying through calm, clear weather experienced purplish, static electrical discharges that covered the entire windshield with a blinding glow. And you know Columbus saw a glow, and his crew, and never could explain it in the area. He found what he thought was India, and he saw a glow. The captain decided to ignore the cockpit instruments and trust the readout of an emergency battery-operated gyro horizon. And with radar assistance from Bermuda, the plane landed safely. There it was found that the craft's electrical system had been destroyed, and it was later necessary to completely rewire the plane and replace all the instruments. Now, present time, according to physicist Wayne Meshagian of Longwood College, Virginia, some kind of energy force is affecting polar orbiting weather satellites when they are over the Devil's Triangle. These satellites transmit pictures of weather conditions in a sequence of two. First, a clear picture, then an infrared one. Since two pictures cannot be sent at the same time, the infrared one is stored momentarily on magnetic tape. What happens, he says, is that the infrared picture is wiped off his receiver. Why only over this part of the earth, he asks, does that happen? Why is it so localized? Until we know the causes of all this, the Devil's Triangle and similar areas will continue to be places of mystery. Regions where the advancing frontiers of human knowledge are on the edge of the unknown. Man has walked on the moon. Our space vehicles have crashed on Mars. By the end of the century, some scientists predict we'll have communicated with other solar systems. And yet we know less about our oceans and seas than we do about the moon. We have yet to reach the bottoms of our oceans to see what's really down there. So the world beneath the sea is still a place of mystery, even to oceanographers, let alone poor laymen like us. One small sector of the Atlantic Ocean is permeated with more mystery and unexplained occurrences than all of the other oceans. These mysterious waters are often referred to as the Devil's Triangle. For here, more ships, airplanes, yachts, and people have vanished without any trace whatsoever than on any other body of water. Let me show you a picture. I like pictures. Particularly for radio people. Love pictures. Just love pictures. Love pictures. Let's see if we can pick this up. Can't find it. I was sure I could find it. Maybe it's in this third group. There it is. See if you can pick up the contrast. Yeah, that's pretty good, Jerry. That's an ocean shot. Stop right there. Come in a little closer. Right there. Doesn't that look like a hole? This round hole in the ocean plunges suddenly down from the shallow 3 fathoms Bahama banks surrounding it. There's 3 fathoms, the gray area around, to a depth which has not yet been firmly established. I mean, you know, I've waded around in hip boots a few times and stepped in a hole. But that's a something else kind of hole. Just straight down. Depth recorders have not found bottom at 2,800 feet. The diameter of the hole can be gauged by comparing it with the 50-foot carry craft to the right of center. Now, 6 times that would be a football field. So that'll give you some idea of the size of the hole. Don't practice walking on stilts around here. The mysterious depths, in spite of the great Frenchman's explorations. Now, before I go back to that mayor flying, in October 1954, still reading from The Devil's Triangle 2, Richard Weiner, the Coast Guard buoy tender, Smilax, was proceeding north from Brunswick, Georgia, to various points along the South Carolina coast, where she was to replace or repair buoys and other navigational aids that had been damaged or destroyed by Hurricane Hazel several days earlier. Let me tell you girls something. When you fell for that bill of goods that equality demanded that hurricanes be named after men on occasions, you forfeited the greatest proof of your superiority. I don't care how you slice it. One of the awfulest things in the world is to relax because of a hurricane named Peter or John or David. Those feminine names kept you on your guard. You lost, ladies, in the name of equality. You lost the greatest proof of your superiority blowing on the windy seas. Just thought I'd put that in. Sometimes you can engage in overkill, lose more than you gain. As long as they were naming hurricanes after women, every man had to stop and say, don't push her too far. Boy, this is interesting. I've got to look into this a little better. Wait just a minute. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Now look at this a little closer. On October 1954, the Coast Guard buoy tender Smilax was proceeding north from Brunswick, Georgia, to various points along South Carolina coast where she was to replace or repair buoys and other navigational aids that had been damaged and destroyed by Hurricane Hazel several days earlier. Winds of 150 miles per hour had slammed into the Carolina coast at 9 a.m. on October 15th. 98 lives were lost in the United States. In Canada alone, property damage was in excess of $251 million. As the 100-foot Smilax crossed Ossabaw Sound near Savannah, she ran into a very dense fog. Seaman, second class, Ike Levine, now Master Chief Boatswain's Mate at the Fort Lauderdale Coast Guard Station, took over the bow watch just before midnight. Once each minute, the vessel's foghorn bellowed out in five-second blasts as the Smilax fell away through the mist at a speed of under 2 knots. From ahead came the sound of another foghorn. With each blast, the source of the sound seemed to be getting closer. Chief Warrant Officer Creech, in command of the buoy tender, brought his ship to a stop. The sound of the foghorn ahead continued to blast through the fog, but came no closer. Thinking that the other vessel had also stopped, Creech waited. The sound of the other horn came no closer. Creech ordered the Smilax to move slowly ahead. The radar in the bridge showed no other vessel in the vicinity. A minute later, the foghorn of the ship that wasn't there sounded from astern. Still, the radar screen indicated no other vessel in any direction. Then Levine thought he heard the foghorn of another ship ahead somewhere. The radar showed nothing but the shoreline and a buoy. The seaman tightened his grip on the cold, wet bow rail. Again, he heard a foghorn from somewhere ahead in the fog. The first horn was getting lower, as though it was drifting or moving further astern. You ever heard a foghorn on one of those boats? The new horn seemed to be getting louder, yet the radar continued to show only the shoreline and the buoy. It's a U.S. Coast Guard ship. Once more, Creech stopped the Smilax. The Coast Guard vessel drifted. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Strange things happen in this triangle. The Coast Guard vessel drifted slowly ahead with the current. You'd reckon one of those offsprings of the sons of God was out swimming. The Coast Guard vessel drifted slowly ahead with the current. Creech ordered Levine to turn on the carbon arc searchlight. Oh, my Lord. We just joined Memphis, Channel 30. I'm in the Bermuda Triangle, folks, reading from the Devil's Triangle 2. And I'm not going to back up. You should listen to Memphis Cablevision. You say, well, I live out in the country. Buy a dish. Once more, Creech stopped the Smilax. The Coast Guard vessel drifted slowly ahead with the current. We're in the Devil's Triangle, and it's a Coast Guard buoy tender in the fog, hearing boats blowing foghorns that don't show on the radar. So they stop to let a boat pass that isn't there. Once more, Creech stopped. Did I review that quickly enough? Once more, Creech stopped the Smilax. That's the Coast Guard vessel, Memphis. The Coast Guard vessel drifted slowly ahead with the current. Creech ordered Levine to turn on the carbon arc searchlight. As the seaman was plugging in the connection for the carbon arc light, the men on the Smilax, I'd change its name, heard still another foghorn from somewhere ahead. And as before, the radar gave no indication of any ship or boat within its range. The searchlight beam penetrated a short distance into the fog and disappeared. Then suddenly, from above, then suddenly from above came a then. I got it memorized. Suddenly from above came a then, suddenly, from above. You know, if I go walk some of them streets down there in Deep South, there'll be some of these people kill me for this. Then, suddenly, from above, came a beam of light shining down on the Smilax. How it kept smiling is beyond me. The beam moved from just ahead of the ship to directly over it. There was no aircraft above the vessel. The night was dead, dead still, except for the strange foghorns and the Smilax's own whistle. I don't know how it could pucker its lips. Levine, I'm warning you.
No,
we're going to get back to this mayor candidate, you know. Levine tilted his searchlight straight up at the other light. Game of chicken. The other light went out. As Levine turned his light back down toward the water, the buoy tender emerged from the fog. Don't look at me that way. I didn't tell this story. I'm just reading it. I wasn't on that boat. The night ahead was clear. There were no other craft in sight. Still, the men of the Smilax could hear the strange foghorns. Well, let's try another one. The USCGC, that's acronym for United States Coast Guard Cutter, Yamacraw. Well, with names like Smilax and Yamacraw, I'd attack them too if I was the devil. Yamacraw was a former World War II mine layer, converted by the Coast Guard to a combination cable laying and research ship. She had a white superstructure and a black hull. The large letters on her hull disclosed her designation, WARC 333. The name Yamacraw was derived from a tribe of Florida Indians. Captain of the 189-foot ship was Commander William D. Strouch. Her normal complement was 51 crew members. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
All I'm doing is picking a few strange happenings in the area called Devil's Triangle. So we've got to get back to this guy here, though. This guy flying. On August 8, 1956, the Yamacraw was on a heading of 180 or 165 degrees. Her position was 30.65 north and 73.80 west, which placed her in what is sometimes referred to as the Sargasso Sea, otherwise known as Seaweed Sea, where them eels breed. An area north and east of the Bahamas and approximately 500 miles east of Jacksonville. It was 0130 hours when the radar operator called out, "Large landmass dead ahead. Range, 28 miles. "Impossible," responded Ensign Francis J. Flynn. "There's only one landmass on our heading, and that's the Dominican Republic over 800 miles away." The radar operator adjusted and readjusted his equipment. Again, he called the officer of the watch. "Ensign Flynn, the radar is showing a landmass directly ahead on our course. Take a look for yourself." Flynn studied the radar screen. "You're right," he said. "It's got to be a landmass. Look how straight it is, almost as if it were drawn by a pencil. Wake up the skipper. I'm going to check the compasses and take another position fix." The sea was flat and smooth. The sky was clear. Every star and constellation that should have been visible in that area was in view. The compasses were correct, and the ensign's sightings tallied with his previous fix. Still, the radar screen showed a huge landmass directly ahead on the Yamacraw's course. Steaming at 12.5 knots, the ship had reduced the distance to 24 miles. "Maintain 165 degrees, ordered the captain. Less than 2 hours later, those on the bridge were gazing ahead in awe. No more than a mile ahead, looming up out of the sea, was a huge, dark..." Let's go back to this guy. Now let's go back to this guy, this flyer here. Am I boring you?
No!
You torture me and make me wait for my budget. You put me through hell and drive me right up to the wire. Kill me with fatigue, bring me to the point of quitting every day. My turn now. You say, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." That's what I'm doing, making it mine.
This is the end of side 3.